Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, where Greg Hunt makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Last time he was here, he spoke in a more general way about his series of papers that he was doing, which were subsequently published, but tonight he's going to talk about his shadow portfolio. So I'll introduce Mr. Hunt very briefly. He completed degrees in arts honours and law honours at Melbourne University. He's worked in law, in business, in foreign affairs, and most importantly, from our purposes, he's been the member for Flinders since 2001. And in recent times, he's had a number of very important positions in the Shadow Ministry, currently the Shadow Minister for Climate Action, Environment and Heritage. And tonight, the Honourable Greg Hunt is going to address the Sydney Institute on the topic of choosing the right market mechanisms for addressing environmental problems. Greg Hunt, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much to Gerard, to everybody in the audience. In particular, I understand we have former jurists, we have current people in the public service, we have people who have been distinguished in business, and those who are just curious. So I'm delighted to be here. Let me begin by going back to where I finished 2 years ago, last time that I was at the Sydney Institute. On that day, I argued the proposition that people respond well to simple, positive incentives. In my view, events of the last 2 years have only strengthened that position. In particular, the complexity and the failure of the Australian mining and carbon taxes, the complexity and the gaming of the European emissions trading scheme are examples of policy failure when we lose sight of this message of simple, positive incentives. Indeed, since the carbon tax was announced and introduced, as an example, we've seen manufacturing job losses in the aluminium sector, in the steel sector, in the paper sector, cement sector, auto manufacturing and chemical sectors. And the tax isn't responsible for all of these job losses. But industry has repeatedly confirmed that the tax has undoubtedly made a bad situation worse by eroding our competitiveness further. So in a difficult international environment, with a high dollar, with low demand for manufacturing from overseas, with lower cost of imports, the tax has increased electricity and gas prices and added to the challenge for our manufacturing sectors above all else, but also for households. However, what is very interesting is that despite these job losses, which we've already outlined, Treasury still continues to predict that our emissions will climb from 560 million tonnes in 2010 to 637 million tonnes in 2020. So in short, jobs go down, but emissions go up. By comparison, over the last 2 years, American productivity and manufacturing have thrived at the same time as emissions have dropped. Now the cause, of course, has been the simple, positive incentive, and again I choose those words very carefully, of new gas resources unleashed through better technology. And strangely, it was done without a carbon tax. So America's emissions have gone down, but its productivity have gone up. Australia's emissions have gone up, but our productivity has gone down. It's a very interesting comparison. And so against this real-world background of two countries heading in different directions, I want to begin with three simple propositions. We agree with the government on the science of climate change. We agree on the targets to reduce emissions. We agree on using markets as the best mechanism. But we disagree fundamentally on the carbon tax. We disagree fundamentally on what is the right market mechanism to tackle climate change. In short, the real choice is between a tax on electricity and gas and production or genuine market-based incentives for positive action. That's the real choice that Australia is facing. So tonight, I want to help challenge and help change the seemingly received view of some that the only good market is a punitive tax, that the only good market is an electricity tax, and that the only good market is a manufacturing tax. The very notion that a manufacturing and electricity tax is a market, of course, has to be challenged, and the idea that it is good and effective absolutely has to be challenged. As Europe is discovering through bitter experience, and as the United States is discovering through happy experience, there is a better way than massive electricity taxes. That is the lived experience of the international community as we speak. So I therefore want to argue that the right mechanism for the carbon problem is an abatement market, not a taxation market. And I want to do this in three stages. Firstly, by directly addressing market theory and the flaws in the carbon tax. Secondly, by looking at what the world is actually doing, and most importantly, by outlining our simple positive use of the market to purchase the lowest cost abatement. So let me begin with market theory and climate change. Now, I also know that not everybody agrees with the climate equation. I've spoken with people this evening, and there are people across the country of both sides of the view. Yesterday in Parliament, I stood up and respected and argued for their right to put their case. My own view, our view as a coalition, is that there is an issue to address, but everybody should be entitled to their view. So having said that, 4 years ago, the Danish director of the Copenhagen Consensus Centre, Bjørn Lomborg, gathered together a panel of Nobel economic laureates and tasked them with the job of identifying the most and the least cost-effective actions to address climate change. The report began, and I quote, "We've long ago moved on from any mainstream disagreements about the science of global warming. The crucial, relevant conversation today is about the economics of our response." And Lomborg went on to summarise the findings of the Nobel Economic Laureates, all of whom happen to believe in climate change, Finn Kidland, Thomas Schelling and Vernon Smith, and all are recent Nobel Economic Laureates from the last decade. And what the laureates said was, and I quote, "One of the most striking characteristics of the expert panel's findings, obviously, is the verdict that short-term carbon emissions reductions through carbon taxes are a poor response to global warming. It bears pointing out that the expert panel also noted in their findings that cutting carbon through cap and trade would be an even poorer solution." So let me just summarise. A considered panel of the world's most eminent pure market economists concluded that of 15 different systems for cutting emissions, the three worst, the three least effective, the three most costly per tonne of abatement were variations of the carbon tax or ETS. This is what the world's great Nobel market economic laureate said. By comparison, their top solutions were all about smarter technology. Some of the best economists in the world have concluded that the carbon tax is one of the worst systems in the world. I just want to say this because we hear a great deal from the government that this is the only market mechanism that you could have, that this is what the market dictates. And it's not actually the truth, either in terms of being the only system or the right system. And so when you look at the European and Australian experiences, you have to conclude that the economists were right and the enthusiasts were wrong. Indeed, in Europe today, what we have seen is the extraordinary gyrations of a market which is entirely the child of a political process and which is now entirely hostage to that process. And as a result, Stig Schjolset, who is the head of EU carbon analysis for Point Carbon, the leading international carbon analytical firm in terms of trading and the international market, predicts that between now and 2020, and this is a fascinating quote, the EU ETS will not bring any additional greenhouse gas reductions, so it will be irrelevant in terms of reducing total emissions in Europe. This is from one of the supporters, one of the advocates, one of the primary spokespeople who had been a major supporter of the EU trading scheme. And so there's a simple reason why both the EU and Australian systems fail in their fundamental task of reducing emissions. It is that it is the wrong market mechanism for this particular problem. At its heart, at its absolute heart, the carbon tax is just an electricity tax. And because electricity is an essential service, in economic terms, it's a highly inelastic good. One recent international study found that electricity consumption is highly elastic in both the United States and the EU, looking at long-range historic data. The study found that a 10% increase in electricity prices would produce only a 2 to 2.5% reduction in CO2 emissions from residential electricity consumption. In other words, electricity pricing is a blunt and inefficient mechanism for changing household energy use behaviour. In Australia, the New South Wales independent regulator recently found that a 50% price rise over 5 years from 2005 to 2009 inclusive resulted in only a 6% decrease in electricity consumption per capita. So in other words, prices skyrocketed. Demand was not absolutely stable, but it only reduced by a minimal amount compared with the extraordinary degree of pain that was inflicted. That was a national test. That was a major test using the economy as an economic guinea pig, and we saw the results that electricity was again shown to be a highly inelastic good, or in other words, if you're going to use electricity pricing, it's just a plain, blunt instrument. So more recently still, the Australian Energy Market Operator found that just 1/6 of the recent change in Australian energy consumption was linked to massive price rises. So you take where New South Wales started, and instead of it being a 50% price rise, it's now almost 100% price rise. And with an almost 100% price rise, the vast bulk of the drop in energy demand is due to the drop in overseas demand for our goods since late 2008. There's an almost perfect correlation. The energy market operator that says that just 1/6 of the change is due to a 100% increase in price. So against this background, I want to reaffirm the lessons from my own work as an undergraduate 23 years ago. And from time to time, the ALP will elevate this undergraduate work on heavy metal and chemical pollution to the status of a PhD on climate change. It's flattering, but it's sadly false on both fronts. The work I did, however, do in 1990 examined the way in which different types of market mechanisms could be used to address zinc, cadmium, and lead pollution. And where there is a local problem and where there is easy substitution of inputs, pricing can play an effective role. I was very clear about that then, and I remain very clear about that now. The North American experience in sulfur dioxide management and substitution of inputs to reduce acid rain is a clear case in point of an effective use of pricing. But where there is no ready substitution and the costs of switching or of mitigating are high, then higher prices just become a tax. They just get passed through. And there is nowhere that this is truer than in the most essential of all major commodity goods and services, and that is electricity. And in my judgment, it's this failure to understand the nature of electricity and the nature of the goods which are at the heart of carbon production that explains why the carbon tax so badly fails its own test of reducing emissions. Remembering always, emissions go up from 560 million tonnes to 637 million tonnes between 2010 and 2020 under the period of the carbon tax. So in other words, the very purpose for which it was created is failed on the evidence of the government. There is, however, one area where there is an effect from electricity prices, and that is internationally exposed manufacturing. Companies such as Boral, Penrice, Amcor have all cited higher energy prices as a reason for dropping Australian jobs. In Penrice's case, instead of producing in Australia, they have publicly stated that they will simply import from the United States, potentially increasing global emissions as a perverse result. And so what this does is brings me to a realistic discussion of the international environment. And I want to look at the international environment in three phases. What are China, India, together, the United States and the EU doing? What should we be doing internationally, and what are the domestic ramifications of that? So let me begin the international side of this, of explaining what's actually happening, with the statement of the Productivity Commission. And the Productivity Commission said that no other country in the world has an economy-wide carbon tax or emissions trading scheme. The statement could not have been clearer or more categorical. And so then we look at what's actually happening. And let's go first to China. And what the Gano Review third paper said is that China's emissions between 2005 and 2020 are travelling from 5 billion tonnes a year up to 12 billion tonnes a year. What we see further is that rather than the Prime Minister's position that coal power stations are suddenly being transformed, what's actually happening is the greatest growth in coal consumption in human history. Let me take a simple example, the province of Zilongol, or the prefecture. Zilongol is one prefecture of 12 in Inner Mongolia, which itself is one province of 33 across China. And over the current five-year period, Zilongol is adding 24 new coal mines and 8 new coal-fired power station clusters. But it has a population of only 1 million. And so this is an area which is an exemplar of the reality of what is actually occurring. If you want to gross up coal production across all of China, what we see is that Chinese coal consumption is going from 1.4 billion tonnes in 2002 up to what was going to be the limit of 4 billion tonnes in 2015. But only last year, Minister Wu Yin made the statement that between 2015 and 2030, Chinese coal consumption would continue to grow to 7.5 billion tonnes. So going from 1.4 billion tonnes to 7.5 billion tonnes. That is the reality of what is occurring in China. Now, other things are occurring. They are doing things to try to change and address the pace and rate at which their emissions grow. But the Productivity Commission statement remains absolutely clear. Now then we go to India, and what we see in India is growth in emissions over the same period of 2005 to 2020 of 75 to 94% according to Frank Yotso of ANU. That's the second fastest growth in emissions in human history, not just in contemporary terms but in volumetric terms in human history. They do have a $1 per tonne coal tax. Queensland's equivalent royalty is about $20 per tonne. When you go to from India, though, onto the United States, a very interesting thing has occurred. On three occasions since the election, the White House has said categorically that we will not be proposing a carbon tax. Even in the President's speech to the Congress as part of the State of the Union, The president made it clear that the likely path will be smarter technology and energy efficiency. That's where the United States is heading. Jim Sensenbrenner, a senior Republican in the Congress, has said that there will be no carbon tax in the United States under any form, in any circumstances, in his judgment. Both sides are agreed on that. And so you then look at Canada next door, and the Canadians held an election with very similar background to the Australian one. And the centre-right was successful, not just in a little way, but in a categorical way. And the Canadians will not, in my judgment, embark on a carbon tax or equivalent scheme at a national level in the next 20 years. In Japan, a carbon tax has been deferred indefinitely. In Korea, there will be a version of the scheme, but almost all the permits will be given away for free. And that is the reality. So let's then turn to Europe. And Europe certainly has an emissions trading scheme. But what is interesting here, and this is work which the Minerals Council did, the Minerals Council found that over the first 5 years, the European scheme had a total cost of approximately $500 million per year in auction permits. So an average of $500 million a year. That's over a population of 500 million. So an average of $1 per person per year. The Australian scheme is a $9 billion a year tax. That is an average per person with a 23 million population of almost $400 per person. So the realistic comparison between the EU and Australian schemes is a dollar per person as opposed to $400 per person in Australia. That's why there is nothing like what we have anywhere else in the world. Because everybody essentially gives the vast bulk of their permits away for free. They auction the top level. We auction the vast bulk at the highest price. And that then brings me to the issue of price and the comparison between Europe and Australia and the domestic ramifications. The domestic ramifications come from this. Right now, at this moment, what we have is a domestic price in Australia of $23 and a European domestic price on a much thinner number of permits of between $4 to $5 Australian. The Australian price will go up again on the 1st of July this year and up again on the 1st of July next year, and then the year after that, 1st of July 2015, we are likely to see some sort of budgetary crisis because the price may well drop, or you know, if things change in Europe, it could go up. But the prediction at the moment is that we'll have a budgetary crisis. We've just had a $5 billion write-down in revenue, and our analysis is that the government is predicting a price of $12.10 and then $18.60 when it floats. The European market is predicting a price of well under $6. And in other words, that's phantom revenue they're projecting into their budget of $2 billion in 2015 and $4 billion in 2016. So the real point here is that we have tied our domestic system to an utterly volatile system overseas, over which we have no control whatsoever. So we've made our budget and our electricity prices hostage. So all of this brings me now to what are the steps forward? What could we do internationally? And we've said that there are some simple practical things. We think Australia, as chair of the G20, can help to try to bring together the G4 of China and the United States, India and the EU. We ought to be able to do something in terms of a rainforest recovery agreement. Doesn't matter where you stand on climate change, it's a simple practical thing, which is a strong biodiversity initiative, which would also be the single biggest improvement in emissions worldwide. And the third thing there is to look at sectoral agreements. They're simple, practical things. But what do we do domestically? If it's clear that the carbon tax is neither economically responsible nor efficient in its primary goal of reducing emissions, this then brings me to where we're heading. And there are really four simple parts to what we propose, and that's the structure, the costs, the supporting mechanisms, and lastly, the implementation. In terms of the structure, we are creating a simple carbon purchasing fund. It's also called an emissions reduction fund. And the way that works is by a reverse auction, a classic simple market mechanism. So we will gather together the lowest cost abatement. We will bring that abatement into the market structure, and we will simply buy up the cost curve. That's how water is bought in this country. It's how Norway operates. It's how the United Nations Clean Development Mechanism in large part operates. It's the alternative to the electricity tax. And we are source blind as to where we find our emissions reduction. We will simply do things that you would want to do in any event, and we will buy on the lowest cost basis. So instead of a massive electricity tax, we are having a simple positive incentive of buying the lowest cost abatement. And these are things which you would want to do in any event. The second part of this is the cost. Well, sometimes the government will give estimates. I can tell you, as the person responsible, that there are fixed capped costs of $300 million, $500 million and $750 million over the forward estimates. That compares with a budget estimate of a $27 billion tax over the first 3 years of the ALP system. It is a radically different level of expenditure, because instead of focusing on an inelastic good, we focus on things which actually reduce emissions. This brings me to the third part of our system, and that is the supporting structures. And the things that we will do, we will create three existing mechanisms: the Carbon Farming Initiative, the Clean Energy Regulator, and we will also use the National Greenhouse and Energy Reporting Scheme. And our approach here takes what is already in place, where the Carbon Farming Initiative does precisely what we do, which is it recognises emissions reduction, it records those emissions reduction, and at the end of the year, credits are given out for emissions reduction. We will then offer to purchase those, and it will operate in the same way as a contract for wheat. So if a farmer wants to sell wheat, he or she doesn't have to have the wheat in the ground. What they do is they make a contract. They strike an agreement where at the end of the year they provide the wheat. They don't have to be paid up front, but they have to have the certainty of payment. We don't have to pay up front, but we have the certainty that we only pay if we receive delivery of abatement. It's a very prudent system. So we are paying for services delivered and not before then. And that's an entirely market-based approach. The second element beyond the Carbon Farming Initiative is the Clean Energy Regulator. We'll keep the Clean Energy Regulator. And what we'll do there, because we set up the Office of Renewable Energy Regulator, is we will follow precisely the same approach at the moment, where everything that has been recognised as emissions reduction will continue to be recognised. We will then move at the end of each year to acknowledge what's actually happened, and we will broaden out the range of activities which can be recognised. Whether it's waste coal mine gas or waste landfill gas or energy efficiency, these are all sources of low-cost abatement. Only recently, the government signed Article 3.4 of the International Kyoto Agreement. What that means is that everything we have said could happen will happen. And then all this brings me to the last point here of implementation. How do we take this forward? We will move on day one to repeal the carbon tax. We will move in week one of Parliament, if we are elected, to implement the legislation. That will go through the Parliament at the will of the Parliament. But at the end of the day, our hope and our goal is that we will achieve this within 6 months, and we expect that the ALP will respect the mandate, that the next election either way will be a referendum on the carbon tax, and we expect them to respect that mandate. At the same time, we will hold a white paper on our process, open for submissions on day 30. We will go into a round of consultation on day 60. We'll produce a paper by day 100 with draft legislation, another round of consultation, and we aim to legislate at approximately day 150 and to be in action by the 1st of July 2014. So to repeal immediately, but to rightly consult and take our time in cautiously implementing our approach. So at the end of the day, the choice that Australia faces is, which is the best way to address the problem. And there are two radically different approaches. One is an electricity tax, which, as I have set out, at its fundamental heart, fails because this is an essential service, and the history of work in this space around the world is that taxing electricity is just a dead weight on the economy. And the alternative is the simple positive incentive of a reverse auction of incentives for action, which is ultimately also, in my view, a much more positive view of how people operate, of what Australia can do, and how we can achieve our results without taxing Australia. Thank you.
Many thanks, Greg Hunt. Very impressive. Delivered exactly to time without reading the speech. So pretty impressive performance. So I'd just like firstly to say thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility this evening. I understand this is the most energy efficient building in Australia, so it's a good place to be. And there are copies of Mr. Hunt's speech. We've got some copies here. If anyone wants a hard copy, it's I can give it to you after. So we come to questions and discussion. Just on a slightly broader point, for an opposition front bencher or politician, you're pretty well known and you're pretty active in your electorate, as you know, and you've got a rather diverse electorate in Flinders. Do people really care about this issue very much? I mean, is this the kind of issue that your electors raise with you, or is this the kind of issue that you raise with them?
The answer to that is that people do care. What is the biggest single issue in the country at the moment? And I can tell you from published research, but also being honest in terms of what we hear anecdotally, as well as through our own research, cost of living. Cost of living remains the number one issue because it's the thing which most genuinely affects people's lives on a day-to-day basis around the kitchen table. And what is the number one issue in cost of living? Electricity pricing. And they associate electricity pricing with the carbon tax. It didn't obviously cause the rises beforehand, but it caused the rises afterwards. It was responsible for two-thirds of the biggest quarterly rise Australia had ever had, two-thirds of our increases over the course of this year. And so people raise electricity prices and the linkage with the carbon tax every day, whether you're in Western Sydney, whether you're in the southeast of Melbourne, if you're south of Perth, in all sorts of strange places around the country. It's each and every day.
Does anyone care about your solution to the problem?
The general view in Australia is this, and there's no uniform position, but about two-thirds of people care about climate change or believe that there's a human impact. About one-third, and that's still, you know, 5 to 6 million have their questions, and that's a democratic right for them to do that, and I have been a strong defender of their right, even though I may disagree on the view. The flip side is about two-thirds of Australians are opposed to the carbon tax. So in terms of the solution, what people want is to address the issue, but to get rid of the carbon tax. And therefore, there is some debate about the opposition's view, but there is a lot of debate about the government's.
Question here, Sharon.
Yes, in your presentation, you mentioned that Australian prices are not controlled by us, they're controlled by overseas things. And the Reserve Bank's concerned about that, and manufacturers concerned about that. Have you looked at the market mechanism whereby we have a complementary currency which is valued and so is defined by our own local resources to isolate us from overseas prices, manipulation by governments, manipulation by the central bank with interest rates, and so we can so relative values of resources are defined by us and not by overseas people?
Sure. So this, for those up the back, was a question about whether we're looking at an alternative currency structure. The answer is no. I respect the point, but I think that the best protection for Australia is where we have a floating currency, but we are responsible for our own policy. The real problem with the tax, of course, is that it has now been almost exclusively tied for its floating period to decisions taken in Europe. And that's the point that I find clearly objectionable on sovereign grounds, but also objectionable in terms of pure policy of being able to adapt, because the Europeans may well be able, may well drive up their price or drop their price, but they may well drive up their price, but in a way where there's very thin purchasing. So in other words, they could have a high price but a modest impact. And however, for Australia, who are price takers, we would have a high price with a massive impact. And the government is predicting that the price will actually end up at $38 by 2020. Now, whether that's credible or not, who knows? But if it is credible, that's a massive problem for Australia's manufacturers, even bigger than we've got now, and we have absolutely no control. So respectfully, we're not looking at changing the currency or the way in which the dollar is treated internationally, but we are sure looking at taking control of electricity prices and budgeting.
Thanks, Greg. Nearly every day in the paper, New South Wales seems to be dealing with an interventionist environmental minister, whether it be mines or coal seam gas.
Oh, you mean a federal minister?
Federal minister, national parks. Can you tell us your feeling about that? Would you be an interventionist agricultural minister?
Sure.
The question is, are you going to intervene in New South Wales if you get there?
Well, actually, one of the things which we have proposed is a one-stop shop for environmental approvals. And what does that mean? I am not looking at changing standards at all. I think we do have to have proper standards. But I am very taken by the New Zealand model. Where New Zealand, and nobody would accuse New Zealand of low standards in environmental management, New Zealand has created a one-stop shop with a 9-month statutory limit. Now, I think we should be able to achieve our approvals in dramatically shorter time. I think we should aim for a year and ultimately aim to match the New Zealand model in terms of time. And the way in which we would do that is to strike agreements with all of the states progressively and to do it so as there is a single set of documentation, a single set of assessment processes, and then a single approvals process. This was the government's position throughout 2012 until it wasn't their position at the end of 2012. And that was after there'd been a little issue where the Greens had threatened them. However, our view remains very clear that we should maintain standards but simplify processes. New Zealand's the model. Of course it can be done.
Question here?
My understanding,
just speak up a bit. Yeah.
My broad understanding of the carbon tax, it was supposed to be generally revenue neutral. They were going to tax the polluters and sort of compensate the downstream users. Mm. If you're going to eliminate it, what's going to happen to our electricity prices? Are they going to go back down, or
yes,
do you expect, what's the immediate impact from you?
So electricity prices will drop by the amount of the carbon tax. So on average, it's between 2 to 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour. The one positive thing is that it's added at the end of the bill. So it's not integrated into the entire pricing. It's added as an additional component. The best indicator is that I'm informed by one of the banks that forward prices for the 1st of July 2014 for electricity have a 70% probability factored in that the carbon tax will be removed and reflected in the price. So they are reflecting 7/10 of the total reduction, or 70% of the carbon tax being removed based on the probability. If the carbon tax is removed, if there is a change of government, then the expectation is that 100% of the carbon tax value will be removed. So on average, that'll be 2 to 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour. In the medium manufacturing sector, the Australian Industry Group found that there's a 14.5% effect because of the carbon tax, because they were on lower tariffs, but they still cop the full 2 to 2.5 cent impact.
And you'll legislate to see that there's no fudge on it.
We will work with the ACCC, absolutely, and I have already spoken, in fact, with the head of the ACCC on that matter.
Geoffrey Damon.
In the current New York Review of Books, Paul Krugman, the Nobelist economist, attacked the influential study of Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff that purports to show that once government debt exceeds 90% of GDP, quote, economies fall off a cliff, close quote. He criticised their study as an artefact of programming mistakes data emissions and peculiar statistical techniques. He also claimed that Reinhardt and Rogoff, quote, had not made their data widely available, and researchers working with seemingly comparable data hadn't been able to reproduce their results, close quote. Krugman has been a strong supporter of climate scientists who claim that human carbon dioxide emissions are likely to cause catastrophic global warming. However, the criticisms he levels at Reinhardt and Rogoff are identical to the criticisms directed at climate scientists over the last 10 years. The ClimateGate emails reveal the consistent attempts by publicly funded climate scientists to block freedom of information requests for access to the data they use. Once this data is accessed, almost invariably, egregious statistical errors are revealed. The Canadians... there are massive errors in everything that climate scientists produce. Finally, Krugman, and I won't listen to these...
Jeff, it's got to be quick.
Krugman has stated, austerity economics is in a very bad way. Its predictions have proved utterly wrong. Climate science is also in a very bad way. Its predictions have been proved utterly wrong, as over the last 15 years or more, there has been no statistically significant increase in global average temperatures despite predictions of the climate scientists' global circulation models.
Jeffrey.
Can you... Right, this is my question then.
That's the best preamble I've ever had.
Can you assure us that before a coalition government commits Australia to an expensive direct action plan, $1 billion is nevertheless a lot of money, one, there will be a wide-ranging independent inquiry to examine the science of global warming and whether it is an environmental problem. Two, the inquiry would determine whether a direct action plan by Australia would significantly mitigate this problem if it exists.
Jeffrey.
And three, it should be at arm's length with statisticians playing a leading role because it's statistics where the climate scientists make mistakes.
Let me just deal with two things then. There's public debt and climate science. I do know the work of Krugman, and I spoke last time that I was here about another very eminent economist, in this case was an economic historian, Professor Niall Ferguson, and the point that the collapse of the Spanish, French and Ottoman empires was primarily precipitated by public debt exceeding, getting close to 100% of GDP, and I worry always about public debt, and I made the point then that Europe and the United States, Japan, it's not such a problem because most of the debt is domestically raised, all have levels of public debt which are of deep concern. Having made that point, because I just think it's important to emphasise that public debt, in my view, is a significant risk to the world. Having said that, there is, of course, a great debate about the science on different sides. Our judgment and our view has been that the balance of the science is of the view that there is something real and significant. The great universities of the world, for the overwhelming part, the scientific agencies of the world, for the overwhelming part, have come down. Tony Abbott yesterday was asked this question. Two days ago was asked this question in the Parliament and made it clear that his view and our view was that we accept that. There's always new science that should be looked at, and I'm always looking at new science, but we've accepted the basic position. The thing that you can be comfortable of is, irrespective of where you stand, we've got an environmental program which will do things that you would want to do in any event, and with immediate environmental benefits. So it doesn't matter where you stand on the science. You can support improved soil carbon, energy efficiency, cleaning up waste landfill gas so you don't have crises like the Brooklyn Green or Cranbourne landfill gas disaster, which evacuated a whole sub-region. So they're practical things that you would want to do in any event, and $300 million, $500 million, $750 million... it's not insignificant, but it's nowhere near, it's dramatically less than the scale of the carbon tax, with positive immediate environmental benefits in any event.
Right, so there's a question here, then we come down here. Got to be quick. Yep.
Oh, yes, I'll be quick. I sort of worry that someone might chop down the Amazon rainforest or the rainforest in Indonesia, and our rainfall will be seriously affected, and therefore our livelihood. Am I worrying unnecessarily? Or if what's going to happen, could you subsidise these people not to chop their trees down?
The rainforests matter, and they matter for biodiversity, and they matter because clearly they have an impact on regional weather. I think that's exceptionally well established. One of the things that we did in the last year of the Howard government was put together an international rainforest agreement, in particular working with Indonesia. And one of the things which I would like to do and to advance if we are given the chance to govern is to work towards a global rainforest recovery program. And again, it doesn't matter where you stand on the science. It is the most significant and important biodiversity and environmental work, along with ocean protection, that we could do anywhere in the world. And so that's something which I will pursue, and that rainforest recovery agreement is something which I think Australia can help deliver, no matter who's in government.
Question here.
I feel that there's a lot of concern internationally when we change our policies dramatically, and this is yet another policy, given that we've lost a lot of manufacturing in recent years. How do you think the international business particularly will respond to the change?
Well, we've had lots of discussions around the country with people in business, and the overwhelming view of the manufacturing sector has been sometimes the argument is put that we need the certainty of a system forever. I don't want the certainty of a hanging. Was the way one business leader put it to me, that the electricity and gas prices, the gas I didn't really mention much, is up by 9% exclusively as a result of the carbon tax. So when you put those things together, the best thing you can do for Australia is to remove the tax. And I think that no matter who wins, this election will be binary, and the systems will be in place for at least 20 years. Either if we lose, well, I think that the carbon tax will be here for a long, long time. If we are successful, I do not see that the ALP will either block it or return to it in the next two decades.
Okay, now we've got to move on. Okay, so there's a question here.
It will certainly help.
Yeah. Sorry, what was that?
Oh, the question was, will it help with manufacturing? It will help with manufacturing.
Okay, right.
Mr. Hunt, you've emphasised the 10% factor in our electricity bills. My understanding is a not insubstantial portion of my bill that comes in that is where the generators are forced to invest in renewable energy. And that's not been mentioned, and it's another chunk.
It's a fair question.
What is going to happen under your auspices with that?
Okay, so in terms of... this is a question about the impact of the renewable energy target. New South Wales IPART, so your state regulator, in the last 12 months came out with an assessment of the impact of the renewable energy target. Peter Boxall is the regulator. He was John Howard's Secretary of Finance, so a very esteemed economist and policy practitioner. He found that there would be an 18% regulated price rise over this year, which we are living through now. 9% of it would be the carbon tax, 8.7% would be other things, and 0.3% of the price rise would be the renewable energy target. So it was 1/60th of the total additional price and 1/30th of the addition which the carbon tax made for this year.
Okay, so there's a question there, then we go here. Yeah.
Minister, I have a question complimentary to this.
Only shadow at this stage.
Get used to it. Okay.
The question of what causes the increased price of electricity is partly that, and partly to do with this poles and wires.
Absolutely.
And all that, the big gold plating of that. And there's a great deal of static around that, and I suspect none of us understands why. What really is, you're talking about the tax.
So you've had a series of factors which have impacted electricity. One has been the carbon tax. That's been the overwhelming force since it came in on the 1st of July last year. So it's been the overwhelming force. Prior to that, of course, it didn't exist and it wasn't responsible. But network charges have been the largest source of price rises over the last 5 years prior to that. And network charges are basically making sure that there's security of supply. Now, there are some very significant things we can do, the most important of which, in my view, is demand-side bidding. You say, what's that? It means that on peak electricity demand days, which is overwhelmingly the hot days, that the suppliers or other people can bid in aggregated reduction. So you might have a supermarket, you might have Coles or Woolworths that says, we will take lower tariffs on average so as on the really hot days you can automatically power down our air conditioning or our refrigeration. And if you do that, you don't have to overbuild the networks for, as it's really for the peak days that they're built, you don't have to overbuild them, therefore you can reduce the overall cost. That's probably the most significant thing, but we will also be looking at all of the ways that we can use market competition to reduce electricity price pressure. So,
right, there's a question here. Yeah.
Mr. Hart, I'm interested in the carbon farming, how that's going to work.
Sure.
Can you just explain, like, I've read that it's going to involve millions of hectares, and you've said you'll pay farmers to plant trees. I mean, can you sort of explain, is that like the size of Tasmania or half the size of Tasmania?
Oh, you said, look,
if you pay farmers to put trees in, will you penalise them when they cut trees? Because in Queensland, I've read that they're going to cut down 2 million trees.
Sure. So the way the carbon farming initiative works is it's an opt-in scheme, and what happens there is that there's what's called a baseline that's set. So you look at what was happening beforehand, and if you can reduce your emissions through any number of activities, but they are reducing methane in piggeries, they are reforesting. You might have avoided deforestation. You could now have soil carbons included as of a decision 2 weeks ago, grazing changes, cropland changes. But most importantly, we would expand it out to include all forms of emissions reduction. The world has numerous different forms of emission reduction and methodologies for recognising it, the simplest of which is if you reduce the overall consumption in power for 100,000 houses because you've gone through a process of energy efficiency, you look at the consumption before and the consumption afterwards and you credit the difference. And so there's a whole variety of ways. So we're not trying to predict or preempt which forms the market would select, but it would be a pure market mechanism in terms of purchasing. You start at the lowest costs and you buy up the curve. I've got to say, since we did our initial calculations, the volume of abatement is higher, the price is lower, particularly with the European influence. It hurts the government because it blows their budget, but it helps us because it makes our system cheaper. And so I'm pleased about that. However, at the end of the day, it will be the market that determines the lowest cost forms of abatement.
Right down the back, yeah.
Mr. Hunter,
stand up, please.
You can stand up because you're not near the camera.
Ms. Hunter, you talked about the US experience they did not have a carbon tax or even an emission trading scheme. That means moving money from the private sector to the unproductive government sector now, so that they would have more money in the private sector to develop the technology. We've been mentioning that. Now, my question is that have you considered not going full way to the free market side or to the tax side? Have you considered just decentralizing to the state governments, giving them, saying, these are the targets, you deal with it, the funds, and we'll leave it to you. As long as you meet the targets, that's fine. Each state has different requirements.
Questions have you thought about decentralising to the state governments?
Look, it's a great question. In fact, what we're looking at is having, instead of a series of state schemes, one single national system. People are desperate for a single national reporting scheme rather than a multiplicity of schemes. Our business has said, look, in some cases we have 5 or 6 different schemes to contend with, and we want a single, simple national scheme. In the same way, the other half of the equation is that we're looking at a single one-stop shop for approvals, but where the states would have the primary responsibility. The federal legislation will remain, the federal department will remain, but we will become much more policy setters rather than people doing assessments of projects throughout the country. So there's a decentralisation on approvals, but a single national system rather than a multiplicity of systems for climate.
Just a final question on the Clean Energy Fund. As I understand it, I think it comes in, I'm not an expert, I think it comes into operation on the 1st of July, and the people running it have indicated an intention to sign up close to $1 billion worth of contracts before the middle of August. So they're pretty energetic. How would you unwind all that if you win government? It seems to be a huge contractual commitment in what appears to be a very short period.
Sure. Look, I should acknowledge respectfully that the Clean Energy Finance Corporation is represented in the room, and our issue is not with either the board or with the executives, it's with the government, which has set the parameters. Now, not everybody will agree with this, but our view is that $10 billion has been allocated. It's funds which, of course, will have to be borrowed. Ultimately, the taxpayer will have to pay them back. And in particular, what we are concerned about is the speed with which those funds will be put out the door. What we put in writing, Andrew Rowe and myself, to the chair of the board, was that you have a remit which begins on the 1st of July. The writs are issued in early August, therefore there's just over 40 days. The prudent thing to do would be to wait until after September 14. If the government is re-elected, then proceed. No time will have been lost. If the government is not elected, then we will have been cautious and prudent. But we will not proceed with any further funds. We have been clear on that, crystal clear.
Thank you very much. That was the 40 days and 40 nights all over again.
It was. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's been great to have Greg Hunt back at the Sydney Institute. I've always thought that he really tests political skills in opposition rather than in government, and without question, Mr. Hunt's been one of the finest performers in the opposition over recent years. If the coalition wins government, he's going to have a very important portfolio. So we're very grateful he could spare time tonight to come and give us a comprehensive discussion about the coalition's environmental policies. And we hope, whether in government or in opposition, he can come back here in the future. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.